good afternoon. I'm Kevin Clements, Director of the Toyota Peace Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the sixth public conversation on building stable peace in Northeast Asia. We're very privileged to be having this conversation with one of Japan's foremost China and foreign policy experts, Professor Akio Takahara of Tokyo University. I've known Akio for many years and have always been impressed by his intellectual rigor and deep knowledge of China and Japan-China relations. Akio Takahara is Professor of Contemporary Chinese Politics at the Graduate School of Law and Politics at the University of Tokyo. His career has been an interesting combination of academic and policy work. He received his DPhil in 1988 from the University of Sussex and had many interesting assignments inside and outside of the academy before joining Tokyo University. He currently serves as Senior Adjunct Fellow of the Japan Institute of International Affairs, Senior Fellow of the Japan Forum on International Relations, and Executive Director of the JICA Ogata Sadako Research Institute for Peace and Development. So welcome, Akio. I'd also like to introduce everyone to Professor Hugh Mile, who's coordinating Toga's program on building stable peace in Northeast Asia. Both of us will be interviewing Akio this afternoon, so welcome to you too, Hugh. Akio, I'd like to just ask a personal question to begin with. Can you let us know what sparked your long interest in the political economy of China and Chinese foreign policy?
Well, you know, since my childhood, I have been very much interested in China, first reading the Chinese classics, you know, rewritten for Japanese children. We all read those things, like The Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And I took up Chinese as my second foreign language at university. I used to love reading these Chinese classics in my high school days. You know, we all have to go through that in Japanese high schools. And then when I was a student at my university, I got very much interested in what we used to call the North-South issues at that time, you know, the development of the third world. And I wanted to take this up as my profession. And I went to England for my graduate studies. Both my MPhil and DPhil were done at IDS, the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex. And I chose China, you know, my favorite country, as a topic of research, because as you all know, China was a very poor developing nation at that time. So ever since, I've been interested in Chinese political economy. And after China started to grow economically, another theme came up, that is how we should deal with China, how China should deal with its international relations. So that's a relatively new topic for me, but it takes up a lot of my time these days because of the issues that you all know.
Great.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Professor Takahara, and it's wonderful to have such an expert on China, China-Japan relations. I wonder if I could begin by just asking you how you'd assess the present state of China-Japan relations. It's a difficult time for them, and what do you see as working well in the relationship, and what do you see as problematic?
The state of Japan-China relations is in a very disappointing situation. This is the 50th anniversary of the normalization of relations between Japan and China. And also we can say that our relations have developed greatly, especially in economic terms. The amount of trade, the amount of investment, the number of people living, the business people living in Japan, in China, or those Chinese who have come to study and stayed in Japan. So generally speaking, the relationship has developed very much. But on the other hand, we have a lot of issues, increasing issues, especially in the area of security, and that's causing a big headache, especially on the part of the Japanese, that because we feel that there's a lot of physical pressure being exerted on us. Have we really improved our mutual understanding? Unfortunately, there's a huge perception gap between the Japanese and the Chinese about Japan-China relations or about the other side. And that's based on a huge gap in information. There's a huge information gap. The information that the Japanese get, information that the Chinese get are very, very different. And that's causing a lot of misunderstandings. And that's very worrisome.
That leads nicely into the next question, Akio. I mean, Japanese public opinion polling sort of over the past decade has generated very, very negative views of China and the Chinese people. I mean, apart from the information gap that you've already suggested, can you explain why this is so and why it's so persistent and what might give Japanese people a more positive view of China?
Now, according to the public surveys, which ask, why do you have a negative image of China? In recent years, especially the past 10 years, the highest answer is every year is the same. That is because the Chinese send their vessels and aircraft to the Senkaku Islands. And you know, 10 years ago, the Chinese started to send a lot of their Coast Guard vessels into the vicinity of the Senkaku Islands, which they call the Diaoyu. This is a real physical pressure that they are exerting on us. So that's the major reason. So I always tell my Chinese friends that if you are serious about improving Japan-China relations, you have to stop sending these vessels. Go back to the situation before 2012. And the first Coast Guard vessels that came into the territorial waters around the Senkakus to claim sovereignty was 2008. Before that, there was none. So let's go back to that stage. Otherwise, the Japanese will always have this grudge against this physical pressure that we are feeling. So that's the situation.
The Senkaku Islands have become such a major point of dispute between the two states. But it is, from your perspective as understanding both sides, is there a scope for diplomatic efforts to try to smooth or find a solution to this territorial dispute, because the Chinese have perceived themselves as having a stronger claim to these islands as Japan. I'm sure the Japanese dispute that completely, but it seems that the Japanese public's perception is that they're their islands.
So I think in order to solve these issues, if you cannot solve them through diplomatic negotiations, there are two ways. One is to solve it through war. Neither side want that, of course. And the other solution is to go to the International Court of Justice. So exactly 10 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, then Foreign Minister Mr. Gemba of the Democratic Party wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that if the Chinese want to go to the ICJ, we are agreeable because the Japanese side has confidence that our side will win. But of course, the Chinese won't do that. So apparently, the best solution or the way to deal with this in the meantime is to go back to the original position that started in 1972, 50 years ago, at the normalization of relations. That is, neither side should touch on the issue because Zhou Enlai had this wisdom that if we started discussing this issue, there'll be no normalization because we can't come to a conclusion. It was just the previous year, in December 1971, that the Chinese started claiming sovereignty. No map in China printed before that has Diaoyu Dao. That's the name of the Chinese name of the islands. They all have Senkakus. But suddenly, because of oil, according to Zhou Enlai, according to oil, some historians began to make a fuss of it. But I'm not interested. Those were the words by Zhou Enlai at that time. We should not discuss this issue because once you start discussing it, there's no solution. There's no way out, and we cannot have no normalization of relations. And the Japanese side said that, thought that was fine. So our understanding is, of course, they have a different understanding. But our understanding is that now that China has the national power, the ability to act, they have started to act.
Apart from the senkakus, to what extent is this overall negative view of China determined by, sort of the regional and global containment strategies of the US and others? I mean, are we simply, are Japanese simply sort of accepting this very negative view of China that's been promoted very much by the West and its allies?
Well, the Japanese, unhappiness about Chinese behavior came earlier. You know, Japan has been dubbed as an advanced country in facing new challenges, like aging society or what have you. But I would say rising China, how to deal with the rising China is one of those issues that Japan had to face earlier than other countries. So even before the Americans or the Europeans started to make a big fuss about China, we were very worried and we were very upset by what they began to do, especially the end of the Cold War, but increasingly because of their increased capacity, capability to do things, they have been acting, not only in the East China Sea, but as you know, in the South China Sea too. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese are, in a way, a bit naive about, we find our identity as a pacifist nation. We are not built to go to war at all. And we believe in rule of law. Also, when the Chinese say that the ruling by the Hague International Tribunal ruling is just a waste of paper, we all get mad. We all get very disappointed in a way, because there was such love for China in the past, in the 1970s, 80s, and so on. So a lot of us got very disappointed even before the Americans and the Europeans.
Mm-hmm. It seems a paradox that Japan and China have got such a close and important trading relationship, and they're both either the first or the second most important trader with the other. There are rules, there are regulations. There's the World Trade Authority and there's the RCEP. And so the trade relationship is sort of well regulated, but in security there seems to be nothing like what the West what the West has in something like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. There don't seem to be institutions, and Joe and Lai's old "let's leave it till the future" answer, perhaps isn't working at the moment because the future has arrived. So is there any prospect of institutionalizing or regulating the security area?
We had some hope when there was the six-party talks about the nuclear issue in the Korean Peninsula. We had hoped that that framework will be developed into a permanent security cooperation framework in East Asia. But unfortunately, that has fallen through, and we don't have any plan at the moment. But as you said, it would be a lot better if we had some security framework, a stable one, so that people can live without any anxiety. But at the moment, because of this lack of trust, especially between China and the US-Japan alliance, and the Korea-US alliance, we are very far from that at the moment. We should have more dialogue between Japan and China. The US and China have some, more than us, but that's not enough. So, let alone Japan, China, we have so few channels at the moment. We do have agreed meetings, but we cannot hold them. Once the Chinese get upset, they refuse to meet us. That's the difficult one difficulty that we are facing. But however, a few years ago, you remember Prime Minister Abe made a very successful visit to China. That was 4 years ago. And we both agreed to have a maritime and airborne communication system between the two, between the PLA on the Chinese side and the self-defense forces on the other. So that's good, but it's not operationalized in a very satisfactory way. And there's no communication system between the two coast guards. So we need to do something about that.
Yeah, thank you.
Japan's traditionally committed itself to the sort of three non-nuclear principles: not possessing, not producing, not permitting nuclear weapons on Japanese territory. However, in recent years, and also because of the war in Ukraine, Prime Minister Abe and Suga and Nakashita, I think, have become more and more reliant on the US nuclear umbrella and extended deterrence. So to what extent is there support in Japan for alternative approaches, upholding the peace constitution and seeking to negotiate with China about a security architecture for East Asia and settling the history question and so forth? Or are these tendencies just being relegated at the moment as Japan becomes more and more concerned about general security situation and whether or not it should be doing more to help the US with its extended deterrence strategy?
Well, generally speaking, concern about security is rising. First of all, we have North Korea. North Koreans are launching so many missiles these days. And of course, China's military rise. We feel this pressure every day, and they are increasing their military capabilities day by day. And they have started more drills with the Russians around Japan. Both they have bombers flying around us and also the fleets. And Russia invades Ukraine. So everything has contributed to the rise of security concerns amongst the Japanese. I think this is a very natural situation in a way. But at the same time, as I was trying to emphasize, we have to have more dialogue with the Chinese. But the Chinese at the moment are very fixated with their security, the strategic competition with the US. So whatever Japan does, they see us as a running dog of the US. I think there are things that the Japanese can do, and we should be doing more in trying to approach the Chinese. But at the same time, the Chinese has to come out of this fixated mindset. I call it the Russification of Chinese diplomacy. The Russians have had this for some time. They see their worldview is through the lens of competition with the US. Whatever they see it in relation to the United States. The Chinese are falling into the same kind of a trap at the moment. They're so fixated to win this competition with the United States. And unless they relax a little bit, it's not easy to convince them that we should be talking about this. We have to do something to secure the peace that has been so precious, that's the unfortunate situation at the moment.
You mentioned Ukraine, Akio, and of course, at the moment it's very much over here in Europe the center of concern, and with nuclear threats flying around and President Biden talking about the risk of Armageddon and so on. It's clearly a very serious situation. But I wonder how you assess its impact on Chinese-Japanese relations and more broadly in East Asia. And do you think that the US is going to be sort of so preoccupied with Europe and the dealing with Russia situation that it's going to have to leave more of the burden of managing China to Japan?
Well, certainly Russian invasion and the Chinese tacit support for it has added some elements to the amount of concern that we have about our security. You know, one day after the invasion began on the 25th of February, Putin and Xi Jinping had a phone conversation. And according to the Russians, Xi Jinping emphasized that he respected the act taken by the Russian leader at this critical moment. And basically, that position hasn't changed. Also, as I mentioned, there's been a lot of joint drills between the Russians and the Chinese in recent months. So those make us rather worried about the general rise of this physical activeness of those capable of acting. It hasn't really helped reduce or ameliorate the tension in the region and the concerns that many countries around China have.
And do you think that the Japanese public opinion has got much more alarmed by the Ukraine situation than it was before? Is there a parallel there with the way that certainly people in Europe and I guess in the States too have really got quite alarmed by this at the moment?
Yes, I think the response has been similar in many ways. The immediate response is, something that we had never imagined will happen in the 21st century has happened.
Yes.
This has sent a big shock, I think, to many Japanese that a member of, a permanent member of the Security Council of the United Nations can invade its neighbor in such a way. That has sent a big shock to the Japanese public in general, I would say.
In that regard, Akio, do you see, in Western Europe, for example, there's a definite hardening of responses to the issues of national and regional defense and increased defense expenditure. And is this inducing Japan to increase its own expenditure on the SDF? And is there a sort of a tendency right now for Japan to become more hardline in relation to the East Asia defense alliances?
Yes. So even before the invasion, Russian invasion, as I was trying to explain, our general concern about the PLA activities has been rising. Finally, the self-defense forces are moving their troops from the north to the southwest. It's just beginning in recent years. For a long time, we didn't think that security will become an issue between Japan and China. So the major forces of the self-defense forces have been in Hokkaido facing Russia, facing the Soviet Union. But finally, even the ground forces have bases here and there on the southwest archipelago down in Okinawa. Many people had this idea that there's no other choice, rather reluctantly, about our dire fiscal situation. But still, we have to increase our defense budget somewhat. But the Ukraine crisis, the invasion by Russia, has certainly pushed up this momentum, beefed up the momentum for beefing up our self-defense forces, that's for sure.
It was reported that a defense panel within the LDP had proposed that Japan should develop a strike capability, a counter-force strike capability. And that seemed like a significant change in the Japanese posture. Could you say something about how that's seen in Japan and how you see the Chinese response to it? Because I understand the Chinese sort of see the Japanese approach as becoming more militaristic since the development of Abe's policies, which have perhaps been continued now by Suga's government.
Well, the Chinese official response has been rather critical, predictably it has been critical that such discussions are damaging the peace and security situation in East Asia, blah, blah, blah. And that's one fact. And whether Japan to have those capabilities is going to contribute to our security or not, I think is something that we need to prudently debate. I think there are different views about that. But I think certain people in the LDP think that it is necessary to enhance our deterrence capabilities. But that's debatable, I should think.
It's also related to the, the vexed question of Taiwan, a Japanese minister said, or was said in a conversation that it would be a mortal threat or an existential threat to Japan if China were to ever invade and occupy Taiwan. Do you see the intensifying concerns about Taiwan as really being a stumbling block for Japan-China relationships? And if so, is there any way diplomatically that Japan can mitigate that?
Well, that minister is famous for making a lot of gaffes. Certainly the position of the Japanese government is different from what he said. And it all depends on the situation, how we will be involved or not, in what way, if there are going to be hostilities around Taiwan. But Taiwan is so close to Japan, that's true. And when the Chinese conducted their drill after the Pelosi visit in August, one missile landed only 80 kilometers off an island that's inhabited by the Japanese public. So we got very concerned about that. I think that's quite a natural rise of concern, very close to Japan. Missiles were fired and landed. If there are going to be very serious hostilities around Taiwan, therefore, we cannot be unrelated. It would be a big concern. But whether actually Japan will be directly involved in the fighting or not, it depends on how and how the incident will begin and how it will develop, and all sorts of different variables come in. So it's not decided beforehand. I think that's our policy at the moment.
This is switching subject a little bit, sort of to do some future gazing here. In an earlier public conversation, Barry Buzan and Evelyn Goh talked about their ideas for a potential great power bargain between China and Japan and future scenarios for establishing an agreed order in East Asia. And they outlined four scenarios, sort of reinforced US ring holding, which sort of seems to be what's happening at the moment. Two, a US-China condominium, which seems incredibly unlikely at the moment. Three, a China-Japan condominium, Asia for Asian scenario. And finally, Chinese hegemony. And they contrasted these with the likely future of no great power bargains in the region, which would be continuing fragmentation, Cold War II, and increased likelihood of conflicts. I mean, from a Japanese point of view, what sort of new future scenarios do you see for building a stable peace and order in East Asia? And what do you see as being feasible and desirable?
You know, currently it's so difficult to predict the future. Why? Because China's future is not so decided. What's going to happen to America? You know, in the past, we didn't worry about the future of the United States, but nowadays it's a big issue. We don't even know what's going to happen in 2 years' time when there's the next presidential election. So there are so many unknowns at the moment, but if the United States can hold and maintain the current political system and the basic leadership position, I think it's more likely that China will change. If we hold out, if we persevered and maintained peace for the next 10 years, 20 years, you know, China, I think, will gradually or suddenly change. And without the change of China, it's not easy to strike some bargain, I would say. The Chinese are pragmatic, yes, they're very realistic, so they are rational, but they believe in power, and they would use it when there are chances to use their power. So unless that kind of a regime changes, it's not easy to strike a bargain. Whatever the bargain is going to be, you have to make sure that it's going to stay. The promises are going to be kept. And we need some mechanisms to make sure that that bargain is going to last. Otherwise, but those are very high hurdles, very tall orders that have to be met. So I would say the current situation is going to continue for some time. Both sides will try their best to maintain basic peace, but frictions here and there, the competition will continue, and either side or both sides will have big changes, and then we'll have a new situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you say something about how Japan as an actor would bring about, you know, a situation that would be more to its liking, or more, I mean, presumably this drift into confrontation and, you know, new Cold War is very adverse, really, for Japan's interests. And so, you know, are Japanese policymakers thinking about how to get out of this downward spiral and get into a better situation with China?
Right. From a Japanese China expert's point of view, you know, of course, the Japanese side should not get too excited and overact. But we need China to change. But we cannot shape China. Only the Chinese people can change China. So what we can do is to help to support, assist the Chinese change themselves. You know, even without our help, the Chinese people are changing. So I'm sure there are many bright, open-minded, internationally orientated Chinese youngsters living in New Zealand or the UK. Many of them come to Japan too. But recently, because of Xi Jinping's education, it takes time for them to open up more than a few years ago, let's say. But anyhow, there is hope in the Chinese changing themselves. So what we can do is to have more of them come over. You know, because of COVID, it's been difficult in the past 2-3 years. But we shouldn't stop this flow of people out of China. We should have them in our countries, let them experience our societies, our value systems, and they are changing. You know, so that's just that's seems it's not a shortcut. There's no magic wand. It's going to take time. There are 1.4 billion people. I know, but we should do that.
At the policy level, at the sort of, you know, the think tank or the expert scholar level, you've talked about dialogue. So I know it's difficult to arrange dialogues, and I know that, you know, the party line influences what can be said in China, but can you see ways in which there are lots of bright intellectuals in China, as in Japan, and, you know, how can they be brought together in dialogue?
Right. So if it is through Zoom like this, in an open setting, for example, some official symposium or even a workshop, it's not easy for them to speak their true minds because other people are watching. So direct meeting, person-to-person meeting is still very important. And as I mentioned at the outset, there's a huge information gap, even amongst the intellectuals, because they are mainly reading Chinese things anyway, although they can have access to other languages using the VPN, but you know, you don't do that so often. And the human beings can be controlled rather easily by having the information that they have access to being limited. So this direct conversation between people, I think, is very important, so necessary. And they will come to you and tell you that, you know, you understand, we cannot talk our true minds back home. So whatever the Chinese media report about my remarks, please don't take it as my true feeling. They will tell you that. And tourists also help. You know, the image of Japan amongst the Chinese people had been going, getting better and better, and until 2 years ago when COVID started. And when COVID started, not so many people can come, hardly anybody can come. So the rise of the percentage of those with good image of Japan stalled, and last year it's come down. So we want them to go up again by having more Chinese people come back to Japan.
You mentioned earlier that relationships have begun to develop in a positive framework in the context of the talks over the Korean Peninsula. And of course, China's has got a common interest in a way with Japan in trying to manage the North Korean situation to prevent it becoming very dire. And yet, with the war in Ukraine and North Korea's approval of the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk, and their talk about sending arms to Russia and so on, and China's being pushed closer to Russia by events there, it seems that North Korea is becoming in a place it wants to be, being able to play off its neighbors and is close to Russia. And at the same time, the relations between North Korea and South Korea seems to be almost in a worse place now than they've been for a while. So is there any prospect of bringing China back to a place where it's able to deal to where Korea could be a kind of bridge to better relationships in the future?
China was very helpful, not only when we had the six-party talks, but also 4 years ago, as close as 4 years ago, when the United Nations Security Council adopted this sanctions. The Chinese agreed with the sanctions, they implemented the sanctions, because that was the first year of the Trump administration. And Trump was very concerned about the nuclear developments in North Korea. And in order to stabilize China's relations with the US, Xi Jinping agreed to support Trump's effort to contain North Korean nuclear development. But as you know, at the, that was 2017. And at the end of 2017, the Americans came up with the National Security Report. What was it? National Security Strategy Report. And they put China and Russia together and started to call China as the largest external threat to the security of the United States. And the following month, there was the Defense Strategy Report, and it was written in the same tone. So U.S.-China relations got very tense, and then China changed its policy towards North Korea and invited Kim Jong-un. Actually, it was Trump first who moved towards North Korea with the help of Moon Jae-in at the Pyeongchang Olympic Games. What followed was Xi Jinping's change in policy towards North Korea, and he started to embrace Kim Jong-un. So what's important for China's North Korea policy is actually China's relations with the United States. So if the United States and China can cooperate again, which is not very likely to happen soon, then I think China will be serious about controlling North Korea. But otherwise, North Korea is a chip that the Chinese think they can use in handling their relations with the United States.
In that regard, Akio, the North Korean government just a week or so ago stated very clearly that it would never give up its nuclear arsenal and wanted to be seen as a permanent nuclear armed power. How did Japan and China react to that declaration? Because it raises a big question mark over any conversation with North Korea about denuclearization and certainly wider discussions around the Northeast Asian nuclear weapon-free zone. I mean, is there a sort of a feeling of resignation now that North Korea basically has to be seen as a permanent nuclear power, or are China and Japan still hoping that it might be possible to make them an offer they can't refuse in relation to denuclearization?
Well, sorry, Kevin, I haven't checked exactly what the Chinese government has said about that declaration, but I can guess that, they don't want North Korea to be a nuclear state. The Chinese want to maintain the NPT, because they don't want other countries around China to go nuclear. Yes. They don't want Japan to have nuclear weapons. And if they allowed North Korea to have nuclear bombs, then what are the neighboring countries going to do? This has always been one of the basic concerns for China. So they cannot agree with North Korea with accepting North Korea as a nuclear state. That position I don't think will change.
And just a quick follow-up on that one. I mean, is there any strong desire within Japan to confer nuclear basing rights on the US so that, they have the impression that, deterrence is going to be more permanently secured with, providing basing rights to the U.S. for nuclear weapons?
No, I don't think so. We are still very allergic to nuclear weapons. And if there's going to be an argument for having nuclear weapons in Japan, there'll be a huge demonstration or what have you. And I don't think that effort is going to succeed, at least in the near future.
Yeah. It seems that the US policy towards China now is, well, they call it strategic competition, but it's also going back to a kind of containment that they you know, that practiced in relation to Russia. Do you think that containment is the right policy for managing China? Is that something that the Japanese government would go along with?
No, I don't think it will work. I think the Japanese know that containment is not going to work. So it's very different from the previous Cold War days. We depend on China on many things, including rare earth. The interdependence, economic interdependence has developed so much that we have to compete and cooperate with China at the same time. This two-pronged approach, as I call it, has been at work for some time between Japan and China. And I think many countries have taken up this. There's no other choice. Even the United States, in some areas, especially high tech, there is decoupling going on. But on the other hand, their trade is increasing very rapidly. So complete decoupling is not possible. And under that kind of a situation, I don't think containment is a realistic policy. I think many Japanese think like that.
Right. So it's a matter of accommodating China's peaceful rise and keeping it peaceful, I guess.
Yes, we have to find a way to make sure that the rise remains to be peaceful. And you know, a lot of the Chinese who are for maintaining peace, those who live in Japan, for example, who understands Japan and who understands China, too, they would argue for a realistic approach, that is, try and maintain the balance of power as much as possible. But I would say that's one means. Yes, we should resort to those realistic measures, but at the same time, we need to enhance our cooperation. So the liberal approach, I think, is necessary also, and the constructivist approach of dialogue, sharing values, everything has to be mobilized in order to maintain peace. I think it's that dangerous at the moment.
Aren't there contradictions between pursuing all those different policies at once, a liberal, constructivist and realist approach?
Absolutely. So this is the two-pronged approach of competing and cooperating at the same time is contradictory in nature. But I think we have to live with this contradiction. You know, Japan has had to live with this contradiction, at least in the past 10 years, ever since China started to send all these Coast Guard vessels to the Senkakus. And, you know, it reflects the two aspects in Japan-China relations. That is, we have a very fragile aspect in the relationship around security issues, the island issues, but we also had the resilient aspect in our relationship. That's why in 2018, Abe was able to make such a successful visit. So there's a cycle, you know, I think Japan, there's no other way, but because of the contradiction, there will be disagreements in each country. You know, for the Chinese, they are in the same situation. They have to compete and cooperate at the same time. But if you are a security expert, you know, you will focus on the competition and think that no way we can cooperate with China. But if you are a business person, you know, doing big business in China, you would think, why do we have to quarrel over this or that, you know, but the prime minister or the president or the general secretary has to have a very solid power base and persuade both sides and go the middle way. But it's not easy because this contradiction is going to intensify since the competition is going to intensify and cooperation is going to deepen. So it's going to be increasingly difficult.
On the Chinese side, there seems to be this contradiction too between Xi Jinping's talk about win-win outcomes and interdependence, working together, co-prosperity, and so on, the Belt and the Road, promoting development, a lot of very positive messages, but together with quite a hard-edged nationalism and, as you say, a kind of power-based approach. Do you see the first strand of that as just propaganda, or is it actually something that is really a Chinese pragmatic interest to have a more cooperative and peaceful order?
Yes, as you say, what they say and what they do are wide apart in many occasions. I call it the big power syndrome. It's difficult for China to objectively assess itself. They can't objectively see themselves, observe themselves, and assess themselves. And it's not only China, is it? I mean, big powers are usually like that. It relates to many things, like now, China has the ability to do things. So I call it action firstism. They will just act and let diplomacy take care of the rest, the frictions that those actions cause. And it partly arises from their disrespect for law and rules. When you think about the Chinese domestic order, it's not an order that is supported by rule of law. It's supported by the outstanding power of the Chinese Communist Party. So I call it Pax Communista inside China. But the Pax Sinica that some Chinese envisage around it is just an extension of Pax Communista. That's what we feel. That's what we fear. That's what we see. A good example is what I already mentioned, that is the ignoring the International Tribunal rulings judgment about the South China Sea. And there's also Xi Jinping's personality. That's part of the problem. And all these things create this gap between what they do and what they say. So we all have to be very careful and make judgments not on based on what they say, but we have to observe what they do.
Is government and public opinion sort of firmly behind Japan's policy of building a stronger alliance with the Quad nations? I mean, it took the lead on that and its whole Indo-Pacific strategy. Or is there some concern about the risks of further polarization and the development of an arms race, which seems to be underway between China and the US and its allies? It seems to me that the Quad is an example of that sort of institutionalization of competition.
Quad also has two aspects. One is the strategic aspect. It's just like FOIP, the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. The Free and Open Indo-Pacific has two aspects. One is the strategic aspect, the security aspect, and the other is the economic aspect of it. And in Quad, of course, the Indians, although they have an intense competition with China in the Himalayas and elsewhere, but they don't want the strategic security aspect come to the forefront of things. So the Quad meetings, as you have noticed, emphasize other aspects. And that's fine with Japan. Because with FOIP, the Free and Open Indo-Pacific, we don't call it the strategy anymore. First, we called it the Free and Open Indo-Pacific strategy, and then we called it the Free and Open Indo-Pacific vision. Now, even the vision's gone. We only call it the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. And the Japanese are emphasizing the economic cooperation aspect of FOIP, whereas the Americans emphasizing the strategic side of things. They still call it the FOIP strategy. And if you noticed, the Chinese understand this difference or the difference in our emphases. So when they criticize the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, like in the Sino-Russian joint declaration on the 4th of February this year, if you read it very carefully, they criticize the American version of the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. So they have left some room for cooperation with the Japanese version of the free and open Indo-Pacific. So that's what we want. We know we have to compete with China on the strategic issues. Yeah, that's what we are doing. But at the same time, we need to cooperate with the Chinese. So FOIP should be an inclusive project. That's the position of Japan, and the Chinese know this. So we have still some hope that in the future, when the relations are better again, we can cooperate on that front. So it will be a cooperation between the Belt and Road Initiative and the Free and Open Indo-Pacific by sharing projects. I liken the Belt and Road Initiative to a constellation. We should never be dazzled by the constellation because it's only a concept. Yeah. It doesn't exist in reality. What exists in reality are the stars, the projects. So the two constellations, Free and Open Indo-Pacific and the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, can share the stars, no problem. One star, two star, it doesn't matter. And we can call it part of FOIP. They can call they are part of BRI. That's what we are aiming at the moment.
Oh, that's a very helpful nuance, actually. So as long that gives you an opportunity then to think about ways of which you can advance cooperation. But it also raises some other questions about, you know, whether China and Japan in that context can agree on mutually acceptable terms of coexistence. I mean, if you were to be given the task of developing sort of a peaceful coexistence strategy with China, what would you start with?
Well, you know, for the Japanese, the biggest headache is security and sovereignty. The senkakus are always the focus of things. So if the Chinese start reducing the number of Coast Guard vessels and approach zero, that has to be the basic condition on some, you know, comprehensive or the basic framework of coexistence that we are having. We should go back to the tacit agreement between the leaders 50 years ago that neither side will touch on the issue. The Chinese have violated this physically. And that's what the Japanese don't like the most. You know, we are pacifists. we don't like the use of physical force. So we hate what the Russians are doing in Ukraine now. We hate what the Chinese are doing in the East China Sea and the South China Sea now. So unless they do something about that, I don't think we can have a basic agreement.
And in the medium term, do you see Japan is adhering to its peace constitution, remaining a pacifist oriented country, and is that strain in Japanese politics going to be the dominant one? I guess the long peace of East Asia has been preserved by both Japan and China pursuing economic development and trade and cooperative relationships and so on. But it seems threatened now by the security side. I just wonder if how you'd assess that balance between those who want to keep the peace constitution at all costs and those who think it's time for it to go.
So considering the changes in the security environment I think the debate will intensify, but a tipping point will only come if the Chinese do something very stupid, I think. Unless that happens, I think we will remain as pacifists in whatever way we define it. But I don't think the basic tenet of our peace constitution is going to change.
That's very optimistic.
Well, so we need to do our best to maintain peace and not let Chinese do anything stupid. we need your help. you're far away.
That's right. Well, New Zealand is also walking this tightrope between cooperation on trade. I mean, China is our biggest trading partner, and expressing anxiety around security issues, and particularly around Chinese penetration into the South Pacific. Yes. So we're confronted with exactly the same dilemma, and the government knows that it really has to tilt in favor of the collaborative cooperative relationship while keeping on prodding quietly around security anxieties. So we're all in the same boat here, and I think the question is how to make sure that we maintain a sort of a idealistic constructivist type of position and work on dialogue and so forth, while expanding and increasing and consolidating trade relations, personal relationships, and so forth. So we're all in the same boat.
So I agree. So we need to increase the number of Chinese who think like us.
On that note, Akio, I'd just like, on behalf of Hugh and I and Toto, I'd just like to thank you for agreeing to do this public conversation with us. You've once again demonstrated why you are a leading China scholar in Japan. Your initial love for the country, formed through Chinese culture and literature, I mean, continues to provide, I think, a very good backdrop for you in terms of your own orientation towards the country. But you've also demonstrated to us, I think, very clearly that Japan is seeking a kind of a nuanced and balanced relationship with China, one which builds on both countries' strengths in relation to economic development, but which also keeps a watchful eye on ways in which that security relationship can be improved. And I think you've given us reason for hope while tempering that with some solid realism. So, on behalf of Toda, I'd just like to thank you very much for your frankness and for your contribution. And I wish you all the best in making sure that the cooperative side of things transcends the competitive.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for that encouragement. Let us all work together very hard to maintain peace and leave a good world to the next generation.